Okay, we're ready to go. Not everyone got the message then, huh? She was 17, we're 13. All right.
Oh, I know where Roderick is.
Roderick.
Parking.
Ronald. Jessica. Schuman. That's three. We're at 14, 17, right? I count right? Oh, 13. That's close enough. Okay. We're going to finish up with the discussion of the application of gene fusion. And the reason why these are back-to-back is because what we're talking about for the last part of the class will be using some of the tools that we talked about on Tuesday, and then we're going to finish up about today. So the last part of the discussion on the motion of farming, I'm going to talk very briefly on bacterial evolution, just give you a sense of where these things come into play in the big picture of things. So I wanted to talk about pathogenicity islands as mobile genetic elements because it's a relatively new concept. It's relevant to those of you who are in the ID program in terms of emerging infectious diseases. It's also important in terms of understanding the basic concept of bacterial evolution, whether you're talking about bacterial pathogens or any organism out there. But we're going to talk about it within the context of pathogenesis because that's what we study, and this is where it's been discovered. So what is a pathogenicity island? And again, we're talking about it in the context when we think about pathogens, but if you're thinking about any other type of microorganism out there, you should be able to shoehorn these different genetic concepts into your particular organism as well. So when we speak of a pathogenicity island, it's really a block of genes or a grouping of genes that are present in the pathogen but absent in the non-pathogen. And when you get a definition like this, the inference is that there must be some type of a reference strain. Otherwise, how do you know what your non-pathogen is that you're going to be doing a comparison to? Because the definition of the pathogenicity island is this group of genes which are present in one strain but absent in another. And they have to be related strains in order for you to make that kind of a statement. So you need to be thinking of your pathogen in reference to its closest relative, which is non-pathogenic. So for some species, that's easy. If you think about any strain of pathogenic E. coli, what would you compare it to? Someone said Clostridium?
Fifth
one. Fifth one.
Like
K-12? A lab strain, K-12. Okay? Does that sound reasonable? You're not in your head. David? Only not in your head because she's not in your head. And head eyes behind your head to see if she's not in your head, right? K-12, that sounds reasonable for lab strain. And it was until a couple of years ago, the only strain that was available that you can compare it to. But now there is a sequence of a strain which is available on the NCBI website. I don't know if it's been published yet, but the sequence is available. That is called E. coli HS. And this is a strain that was isolated from the stool of a normal healthy individual. So it's not a laboratory strain. So if you had that now and you wanted to make a comparison with the pathogen, would you use HS or would you use K12? And what are the relative advantages of using one or the other? Or is there a wash and stop talking about it and look me up? What do you think? Robert, next question. Okay.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was frozen shut.
And after all, we just. Why'd you just put your hands on it? So, would you use HS or would you use K12? And why? Remember, you want to compare your pathogen, like an enterotoxigenic E. coli or an enterohemorrhagic E. coli, and compare it to its closest related non pathogenic relative, which would be E. coli, as you said. So do we choose K12 or HS? HS being a normal human strain. HS, why?
The
K12 strain
is pretty old.
Older animal? Yeah, I've heard that used in different contexts, but I'm not sure which one it is.
Like it said, they work with the lab a lot, but the HLS is that was pleasant and it's clean, but then it's actually very, probably.
Okay, good. I think it's an important point too, because if you're looking at bacteria or if you're looking at tissue culture cells or you're looking at primary culture cells, they're all going to be subject to potential variations as you patches them in the laboratory. Because what happens when you propagate things, when you propagate solids? What happens? They get stale, they mutate. What? They can accumulate mutations, exactly. And the kinds of mutations that you're likely to accumulate may not be the ones that you're going to be interested in or what they're going to be, they actually may affect the experiments that you're going to be doing, because what types of variants did you tend to get, particularly in tissue culture? For those of you who are not going to be interested in working in bacteria, this is an important point for you, if you want to work in tissue culture cells. What's going to happen as you pass yourself in tissue culture, and what kinds of variants are you going to propagate? That's going to be a phenotype for the variants that you're likely to get. Yeah, read your hand, Paul. Think. What's going to happen? Propagating cells and culture. They're growing. Adherence? If they need adherence, are you going to find those cells? If you're looking at adherence cells? But you're propagating cells, right? Let's say you get mutants that no longer adhere. What's going to happen to them as you propagate? You're going to lose them. Right? But what types of variants are you likely to propagate? Would you like it or not? Think about that. It's a survival of the fish. So the ones that replicate the best, the ones that propagate the best, are the ones you're going to get. So if you're looking at a cell line which has some mutations in it, which make it grow slowly, and you propagate that, and suddenly, you know, you're starting to see that instead of having to split them once every 3 days, you're splitting them every 2.5 days or 2 days, it's a warning flag that maybe something's wrong with the culture. And maybe our talk there is about the fish to pull out some fresh lines, because what you're going to get is, if you keep propagating those, you're going to get the variants, which are the fastest growing ones. And that may no longer have the mutation or the phenotype you're going to show. So just keep that in mind, and the same kind of thing will happen with bacteria as well. All right? So if you had HS or K12, which one would you like to use as a reference strain? You can go with HS. HS is available because, as Melanie pointed out, people fool around for strains. Meaning they've propagated them, they've been mutated. In fact, if you look at H strain of K12, there is no single strain of K12. There are multiple derivatives of K12, different variants, different lines of K12 that are propagated. Although you can get a strain of K12, which is as close as possible to the original laboratory isolate, which has no mutation in it, which is complete protozoa. Some of them have other mutations or other cumulative mutations. So back to this point, you're defining a pathogenicity island, and you're looking for a block of genes which are present in the pathogen but absent in the non-pathogen, you have to have a reference. So for K12, for E. coli, as I said, it's easy to go to a normal strain of E. coli that doesn't cause disease. For something like, let's say, Mycobacterium tuberculosis, what would be the reference strain that you use there? It might be a little harder for those of you who aren't really speaking microbiology or have a plan just for that, of course.
Bovis.
See, bovis? Bovis is a cattle pathogen, right? It's a bovine strain. But it's still a pathogen. Maybe that's not the best one to look at. Pneumonia? Mycoplasma. So where do we find mycobacteria normal? If it's not the non-pathogenic things. Bacteria. We found them in the soil. So you have some non-pathogenic mycobacteria, which, by the way, for those who are studying for the exam, which folks not pathogenic mycobacteria, you make it positive. Because these are organisms that are out there in the soil, they're not pathogenic. And they have different genes, because they're not pathogenic. Okay, so if you think about it, we do in fact exist in our comparisons, we're looking for perhaps some kind of a reference point so we can say, these are present here, they're not present here. They're in the pathogen, they're not in their pathogen. So that's the next step. To block a gene which are present in pathogens, are genes which are either known or suspected to be involved in material. So sometimes you can look at those genes and say, aha, this is where the toxin is encoded. So you know that's a material determinant. You know that that is important to distinguish the pathogen from the non-pathogen, and it happens to be encoded by a genome in time. Or you can look at some genes and say, well, you know, these look like they maybe encode some surface structures. So maybe they're important for colonization. It hasn't been demonstrated to be important for virulence yet, but it's suspected to be. And that makes sense if it's on this region of DNA is called a pathogenous family. In addition, this is a concept we introduced on Tuesday. The islands tend to have an atypical base composition. So when we talk about G plus C content, over the entire genome of an organism, you can arrive at an average G plus C composition, where you coli 50-51%. So the atypical base composition, with reference to the rest of the genome, is going to signal whether or not you've got a pathogenicity. In addition, and we'll see some figures that, that illustrate this point, these pathogenicity allelies, these blocks of genes, tend to be in or near tRNA loci. They also look like they were at one time in the evolutionary scale mobile elements because they have remnants of some of these elements, like IS elements, prophage genes, other mobility genes such as genes that encode integrases or transposases. So these genes or remnants of these genes are also frequently found within these islands, which suggests something about the evolution of these islands. In addition, the other evidence that they were mobile is the presence of direct repeats at the ends of the islands that mark these. And frequently they're unstable, meaning that these blocks of DNA can excise or be lost from the organism. So all these features are features which define pathogenicity islands. And this cartoon basically illustrates some of those points and also illustrates what we're talking about when we talk about the G plus C content. So in the context of E. coli, for example, where the G plus C for the genome is about 50%, if you look over the entire genome and plot the G plus C content over stretches of 10 kilobases, let's say, or 3 kilobases, and just plot that out, G plus C percentage, you'll get a graph that looks like this. And when you hit these islands, there'll be a dramatic, radical change in the G plus C content. So what you see here is an example of a hypothetical island in a strain like E. coli, where the G plus C content drops in the island. And this is also reflective of the evolutionary origins of the island, being that it came in from some other organism. This was not part of the core genome of the pathogen. It came from somewhere else because this DNA doesn't look like the rest of the chromosomal DNA in the G plus C content. In addition, this cartoon also shows that it has direct repeats at the ends of the islands, insertion sequence elements within them, perhaps a defective integrase gene or an active integrase gene. Maybe this island will be unstable and come out because of the function of this enzyme. And also, it's located near tRNA. So these are all the features that we talked about on the two previous slides. Now, there are pathogenic islands in all kinds of bacterial pathogens. And this is just a list that shows you a variety of E. coli, as well as Salmonella, Yersinia, Helicobacter, Vibrio. And I want you to memorize this. This is just to give you a sense of the variety of different pathogenicity islands which have been described and the types of genes which have been described in these islands, such as homolysins, the path adherence coli, the uropathogenic coli, a high virulence pathogenicity island for Yersinia pestis, genes for invasion, and genes for intracellular replication for Salmonella. The different G plus C content is shown here. The first number being the G plus C content for the host genome, and the second number being the G plus C content for the pathogenicity island. So you can see the differences. So it can be quite dramatic in a lot of these cases. And the size of the pathogenicity island really can be variable as well. It can contain a few genes or it can contain many genes. Look at this column here, and this gives you an idea of the different tRNA genes with which these different pathogens and animals have been associated. And finally, the last point that I made about the relative stability is that sometimes these can be quite unstable, or they can be relatively stable. They can be hopping out and being lost in the population, or they can be quite stable in the population. Now, if we go back to E. coli K12 and look at one example of a pathogenic strain of E. coli, this is a uropathogenic E. coli. And this illustrates the fact that in a single strain of a pathogen, you can have multiple pathogenicity. So for example, in this strain of uropathogenic E. coli, 5 different pathogenic analytes have been mapped. And some of them encode homolysins. In fact, 2 of them here encode homolysins. A couple of others encode genes which are important for iron uptake. And each one of these, if you look at the genes that are in them, you can either identify genes which are virulence determinants, covariance determinants, or suspected virulence determinants. And then again, here, this circular map of the E. coli chromosome illustrates not just the variety of pathogenicity allelens in a single strain, but also their relative locations. And these are all in or close to the RNA genes. Another feature of pathogenicity allelens. A special case I want to point out to you, because you'll hear about this in models, you probably already heard about it in MedMicro, is the Lee locus for enteropathogenic and enterohemorrhagic E. coli. This is a large pathogenicity allelen which is inserted in the cell C gene in these two strains, and the Lee locus, which is important for tight adherence of the enteropathogenic E. coli strains and decolonization of enterohemorrhagic E. coli, have similar genes, that have homologous genes, and the locus, or the island itself, is inserted into the same tRNA gene in these two different strains of pathogenic E. coli. Yes?
So if you were trying to find a pathogenicity island, would you just try to sequence before and after the RNA gene to see what's there?
Basically, what's been found, it's been found in a couple of different ways. Pre-genome sequencing, these islands were found because people were looking for virulence genes, and they tended to find genes in clusters. And I'll show you another example of that in just a minute. Post-genome sequencing projects, you'll find them by looking for these groups of genes which don't look like they fit the rest of the genome. The G plus C counting is different. And then you start looking at the predicted gene products of your breeding frames and asking questions like, do these encode virulence determinants that we know of, or do they encode potential products that can be associated with pathogenicity? So that's how they identify some of these other pathogenicity allelens once the genome sequence is available. But prior to that, it was by looking for and trying to identify specific virulence determinants and then seeing that they tended to be linked or in clusters. And then when you sequence those, you found that they had features similar to what I showed in the previous slide. Okay, so, and I guess this also gets into the question you were asking, Diana, is how do you start identifying these islands? And one way to do it when you have the genome sequences available, as I said, is by comparing between pathogens or between pathogens and a closely related non-pathogen. So the experiments which have been done, which are what we call in silico experiments because they don't require getting hands dirty at all, you just use the computer, is to take a pathogen like enterohemorrhagic E. coli, EHEC 01-57H7, and compare it to a related non-pathogen, your E. coli K12 lab strain. In addition, comparisons have been done between pathogens, pathogenic strains of E. coli, like enterohemorrhagic E. coli versus EHEC, or between strains of enterohemorrhagic E. coli. So you can do genome sequence comparisons and look for these islands. And when they did the comparison between EHEC and E. coli K12 at the genomic level, what they found were over 170 what they call O ions. And these are blocks of DNA that are present in the pathogen, the EHEC strain, that are absent in E. coli K12. So this is all done by looking at the genome sequence and saying, okay, where does the genome look different? And since we have a complete genome sequence, you can say, if you compare K12 and EHEC, where is there additional DNA in the pathogen that's absent in K12 strain? And they came up with about 177 of these. Some of them, which contain virulence genes, and a whole lot of them, multiple stretches of DNA that contain phage-like sequences. I think I might have mentioned earlier during the bacteria phase lecture that EHEC is peppered with either intact prophages or pieces of prophages, which is why the genome sequence of Enterohemorrhagic E. coli strain 01587 is a couple of megabase pairs larger than E. coli K12. A lot of that comes from these oil islands, which were identified when we did the genome comparison. Obviously, when you do this genome comparison, you can also see the flip side DNA. That is that there are K-ions, stretches of DNA, that are present in E. coli K12, but are absent in EHEC. Now, given what I told you about pathogenicity islands, the first bullet point here makes sense. What about the second one, though? What would explain the presence of K-ions? That is, the absence of genes in EHEC. Can you think of any reasons that may lead to this observation? Yeah. They didn't need those genes. So perhaps the absence of these genes in Enterohemorrhagic E. coli comes because there was the absence of selective pressure to maintain them. In the absence of selective pressure, these things will tend to be lost, either by mutation or by deletion. Okay? Yeah.
Those genes are
able to
do with not being
I don't know. The genes that are missing?
Yeah. By losing the genes, is that why they didn't really have to get it? They lost the ability to kind of maintain themselves or keep
okay, that's a good concept. That's a concept we haven't introduced yet, and that's the concept of pathogen-adapted mutation and antivirulence genes. So losing genes sometimes in a pathogen makes the pathogen better fit for the new environment. So yeah, that could be a function of them being a pathogen, is that they had to lose certain gene functions that came from the core genome in order for them to be better functions. So that could explain some of the gene loss as well. If I can think of any other reason why genes may not be present in the pathogen, but be present in any poly K12? It's the easy explanation. You guys come up with a more cerebral interpretation, but this is an easy one because the answer is right up there on the board. Evolutionarily speaking, it's the same four organisms, so they're derived from the same ancestors. So why would some genes be missing in the pathogen? That's what we're asking. Why is it missing in the pathogen? They don't need them? Oh, we've already said that. They don't need them. Because there's no selection maintaining. And one thing you're not thinking about, because I'm not pushing in that direction, but you've got to be flexible here. I'm saying that they're present in K12 but absent in EHEC. You're thinking, well, they were lost in EHEC. Were the original part of K12? Where's the other one? Pre-prophage genes, right. I told you that EHEC acquiring all this extra DNA because they got all these prophages in them, right? Same thing can happen to any bacteria. So there are, in fact, some of these K islands in K12 which represent effective prophages that K12 had accumulated that aren't present in EHEC. So if you look at an evolutionary tree and think about it, so they had a common ancestor, EHEC evolves, becomes a pathogen, and starts acquiring genes, losing genes. E. coli K12, or your gut intestinal non-pathogenic flora, E. coli, isn't a static organism either. So it's evolving too. And perhaps it's losing genes, perhaps it's picking up genes. In this case, prophage genes. So that explains some of these chaos. Is that you get some prophages that come into K12. The fact that if you look at E. coli K12 and look at E. coli HS strains, you should be able to confirm this hypothesis, right? And in fact, there is one K island in E. coli K12 which represents a defective prophage, which is not present in the E. coli HS strain, which is also from the K12. That shows that the strains can evolve independently. And that explains the presence or absence of DNA. Now, an unusual case of a pathogenicity island is the one I'm going to show you here, which is the Shigella virulens plasmid. So it's a plasmid which has a mosaic composition. So if you look at the colors here and look at the key, it basically has a pathogenicity island inserted within the plasmid. And the pathogenicity island I'm speaking about is this group of genes from IPA-J out to ORF131, which includes all of the genes that are necessary for synthesis of the type 3 secretion system and the invasion effector molecules that allow the bacteria to invade into epithelial cells. And the interesting point about this is not only that all these genes are linked genetically as a block, so they look like they're pathogenicity in that sense, but also they have a G plus C content that's less than 40%. It ranges from like 26 up to 33 or 37%. So it's less than the G plus C content of the rest of the plasmid. And in fact, the rest of the plasmid is pretty heterogeneic anyway, because there are stretches of DNA that look like they're about 50%, and some of them are a little bit lower than that. And the pathogenicity island is not the only outsider on this plasmid, but there are a whole lot of insertion sequence elements as well. And that's represented by all these yellow sequences. The plasmid itself